So today we're continuing. I imagine we'll conclude our considerations, and I'm going to say extended considerations regarding Revelation 16 and the seven last plagues of God's wrath. We had a couple more extended scriptures we were considering, and last week we had left off talking about Ezekiel 9 and 10 and what that might represent. So I'm putting this screen share up. Some of you might be familiar with it already from the past. But let's turn to Ezekiel 9 and let's reread there verses 1 through 6, please. And Sister Cheryl, would you do that, please?
Sure, 1 through 6.
Yeah.
9, 1 through 6. He cried also in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lieth towards the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkcord by his side. And they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was, to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen, which had the writer's inkcord on his side. And the Lord said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, go ye after him through the city, and smite, let not your eyes spare, neither have you pity. Slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is this mark, and begin at my sanctuary. Then they began at the ancient men which were before the house.
Okay, thank you. Any opening comments for us, Sister Cheryl?
Well, we know this is a pretty astounding prophecy. We know in, right, starting in the 1800s, you know, after the time of the end, so much knowledge was opened up in liberties that men came out of the woodwork, especially six of them that, started, presenting their own ideas, and they were very contrary to the true word. But we have this one clothed in linen, thankfully, the seventh messenger. And we can see the writer's inkhorn by all his writings and work he did. It definitely sets up. He's the one that had where the mark of the truth could be had. And so it's this period of dividing. And so we just see the work that was done. And it's a great testimony for our faith because we can contrast, you know, what was going on with the truth and the scriptures and what was being presented. Over.
All right. Very good. Very, very comprehensive for us. Other opening comments at this time? Okay. So I'm trying to put my screen so I can, hopefully I'd like to see you all, but speak out if you have your hand up. Okay. Brother David.
Thanks, Brother Rick. I wouldn't have noticed this before, and probably the brethren had, but the phrasing, the writer's inkhorn by his side, we know ink in the past was a form of communication, and we also know that the horn is a power. So to me, that's what it speaks of, and if we hadn't gone through the horns in our previous study in Revelation, I wouldn't have picked it up that way, but it it is, it's more pronounced to me, now every time I see that. Thank you.
All right. Good. All right. Thank you. Sister Gina or Brother Mark.
Well, Brother Rick, I got some notes in here, and in verse 2 it brings out six men, and it says man's message and also man's number is six, and then we've got that along with verse 11, which we think links that to Brother Russell, which probably coincides with what you've got up on the screen there. And then, so man's influence over the truths here. There's, which is interesting because I got like six names here of people that have a negative influence of the truth, like Darwin and Joseph Smith is, and it's hard to read some of these names, Mary Baker Eddy, and I'll just leave it at that. Over.
Okay, very good. Yes, this is one of the suggestions. The one clothed with linen with the riders in corn was the one that had a justification with the Lord, representing Brother Russell, but particularly his writings. And then these six men aren't so mentioned, and instead of having a saving power, they have a destructive power. And as you brought out, man's number. And so it would be the teachings of men at the same time. One saving faith, one destroying faith. But Sister Cheryl, I hope I didn't make your comment.
No, just looking at verse 3 with my notes, I appreciate that the Lord's dealing with the seventh messenger. But these others, they should have been in charge of the Lord's house. They should have been in line, you know, and that's what makes it so easy. If you're not familiar with the scriptures and studied, it'd be easy to get led astray because, you know, unripe Christians, imitation Christians. So, but to be in this position, you should be able to be in charge and give out the Lord's word and be his servants, but these failed. These other ones besides the seventh messenger. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. So those who had charge over the city, those that would reach out to symbolic Babylon. Here it's Jerusalem, but it's representing the condition that symbolic Babylon also represents, and that is Christendom. At the time of our Lord's return, the judgment would go forth. It would begin at the house of God, and the harvest message would save those who had true faith in the ransom gathered around the altar. And yet these six men's teaching would also go forth at the same time, contemporaries, and they would slaughter or destroy those who were weak. Very good. So on this screen share, is, you could see the big words are modernism tests religion. And if you remember our late brother Daryl Green, he actually found this book. If you look toward the bottom on the left, it's a yearbook. It's called Mid-Century Edition, 1900 and 1950. And so as he was flipping through this book, he came across this page that had a picture of Brother Russell. And Brother Russell is mentioned. So when we look at the, in the middle of the screen where we have Brother Russell's picture and those three men, if we read the caption, fundamentalist, scientist, atheist, engaged in a bitter feud over this modernism testing religion. Best-selling author and evangelist, Pastor Charles Russell, left, preached against evolution theory of Charles Darwin Center and the atheism of Robert Ingersoll on the right. Now, that That's all it really says here about Brother Russell. But the point is that we so appreciate they got it right. Brother Russell was considered a fundamentalist in the sense that he fundamentally believed the Bible testimony was true. That's what it means by him as a fundamentalist. And so his teachings would save the faith in the ransom for the true believers, while these other men, their teachings would destroy it. So looking to the bottom of the page, I added these things at the bottom for reference. So you see I have the fourth volume, page 66, Evolution, Higher Criticism, Theosophy, Christian Science, Spiritism, and Other Theories Denying the Ransom. Now, that's what Brother Russell has there. He's not saying these are the six men with the slaughter weapons. I don't mean to give that impression. He doesn't comment on that I'm aware of. But these were things that we picked out that we thought would be similar. In the sixth volume, page 629, Brother Russell comments, the most violent opposers of the truth are evolution, theosophy, spiritism, Christian Science, Romanists, Protestants, and Universalists. And then lastly, we quote, not quote, but we have from the sixth volume, page 658, now in the harvest, the adversary is furiously attacking the truth and turning everything scientific and educational into a weapon of destruction. Now, that's Brother Russell's thinking. And then we just have some other references listed. However, I think it doesn't have to be just a specific six, even though we offer six individuals whose writings were contemporary with Brother Russell that did destroy faith in the ransom and in the Bible. Or they confused it so bad they lost faith. So we just offer these our suggestions. We thought this, though, was very remarkable. So rare we see Brother Russell in a positive light in public. So I'm going to close this screen here unless anyone has anything they want to say about that screen share. No. Okay. Good. So then coming to the point, as Brother Mark said in Ezekiel 9, verse 11. And behold, the man clothed with linen, which had the inkhorn by his side, reported the matter, saying, I have done as thou hast commanded me. So we believe it was the Lord, the Heavenly Father's arrangement, but he sent Jesus back at the beginning of the harvest as the chief harvester, and that Jesus, we're told in Matthew 24, picks a faithful servant to give the meat in due season, the harvest message, to give to the fellow servants. And it would also be that same message would also act as a sickle of gathering the wheat, separating the tares. But we're told here that there's a time when this marking to save faith and the ransom would have done its job. He would have completed it. So we believe it's the writings of Brother Russell that continue to this day. You and I had our faith in the ransom sustained or saved or protected by his writings, because it helped us understand the scriptures on the same. But the time will come when this will no longer be needed. The 144,000 will have been found. And that would be the time then that the message is concluded, as it were, because it's had an intended work. The harvesting of the wheat would have been successful. But that brings us to the 10th chapter. The story continues. But I want to take a breath here before I go further and just ask, are there any comments or questions on what we've discussed so far this morning? Ruth.
Had a quote on the third volume on page 166. The classes are to be marked and separated before the plagues come upon rejected cast off Babylon.
Okay, very good. That's right in. Okay. Any other comments or questions? So let's read here in Ezekiel, chapter 10 and, let's see, Sister Connie, could you read there for us? We hope you're feeling better too.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Good. Could you read for us Ezekiel 10 and read, one and two, and then skip over to 6 and 7. 1 and 2, 6 and 7.
Then I looked, and behold, in the sky that was over the head of the cherubim, there appeared above them as it were a sapphire stone, as the appearance of the likeness of a throne. And he spake unto the man clothed in linen, and said, Go in between the whirling wheels, even under the cherub, and fill both thy hands with coals of fire from between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city. And he went in my sight. And it came to pass, when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, Take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim, that he went in and stood beside a wheel. And the cherub stretched forth his hand from between the cherubim unto the fire that was between the cherubim, and took thereof, and put it into the hands of him that was clothed in linen, who took it and went out.
Okay. Thank you. So I know we're just jumped right in here, but Sister Connie, any opening comments on these verses?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, Brother Dan, since the mic's open, opening comments here?
I do have a note. And I'm just going to read my note. Chapter 10, the command goes forth to destroy the city. The seven last plagues, coals of fire, the burning of the terror. So we have this connection to the seven last plagues in Revelation 15 and 16, which destroys the city, which is Christendom. And it's the truth, of course, the hard truth that destroys the city. And it connects back to the writings of Brother Russell, verse 2, the man with the writer's inkhorn, and 11 that we read. And so those who are marked in their minds, and of course their hearts, by the truth that Jesus brought with him, if you will, in 1874, and using the seventh messenger, these ones are able not only to overcome the these errors, these destructive teachings in the harvest of the gospel age, but they're able to speak forth the truth in order to plague and destroy Christendom. Over.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. Further comments on these verses? Ruth.
I have a note that the cherub is justice, one of the attributes, and that the one that is responsible or active here is justice.
Okay, good. Last week we talked a little bit about that, and we made a link to Revelation 15, verse 7, that it was one of the four living creatures that gave the seven last plagues unto the angels to distribute. And we thought there, again, it was fitting it would be God's justice that would accomplish this destruction. Further comments? Brother Chris.
Yeah, I think the friends have said it well. I just a couple of highlights on some of the symbolism. That verse 1, I think we discussed that sapphire was blue, so it represents the faithfulness of God's word. And the wheels, of course, are dispensations. And since all this discussion is between the wheels, we would say that would be the harvest time, between the gospel age and the millennial age. And and the friends filled out the rest of the judgment. The fire that's passed out is the judgment message and the destructive judgment. And but whenever you destroy things, you're also refining it. So everything is like purified to it. So we often separate the difference between the refining of the fire and the fire of destruction, but normally they do the same work at the same time. It's not always. Sometimes it's refined into oblivion, just like the papacy, et cetera. Over.
Okay, very good. That's true. Very true. Thank you. And we appreciate, even as your divine planet age chart behind you, when we studied the wheels of God's great chariot in Ezekiel, the first chapter, we saw here similarly that these ages, dispensations, that we liken the point that they were rounded, almost as if they're wheels within wheels that were turning and moving forward in the plan of God. God's plan moves forward in time. God created time. And one of the proofs are the prophecies he gave, which are time prophecies that had been spoken, given a length of time, and given their fulfillment events. So we see that God's plan moves forward. And when we see the wheels are turning, it implies that a new feature, a new event in the plan of God is taking place. It's beginning. And here the wheels turning would represent that since Brother Russell's writings, the harvest message, has sealed the 144,000, saving their faith in the ransom, then the next feature in the big picture would be the same message, the same truths would then destroy the city, the false city here, Jerusalem in Revelation. It's Babylon. Mystic Babylon, Christendom. And it destroys it by it revealing the errors, which then burn the bundled tares, as was just stated, which then will lead to the great earthquake and eventually into anarchy. So that was our connection. And thank you, Brother Chris. That's a great picture. God's throne sits above the wheels, supported by the wheels, and as it were, like clear crystal ice, very fitting to denote God's mighty celestial chariot, but it really symbolically represents that it's God's plan and purposes that move forward through human history. Okay, thank you. So are there any other comments here in Ezekiel 9 or 10? Okay. I just wait a minute for things to set in. I know I'm late on the draw too at times, but all right. Then the other picture that we had mentioned in the days preceding was regarding Jezebel. So we'd like to turn to 2 Kings chapter 9, 2 Kings 9. And let's see. Sister Brenda, are you able to read? I see you have listening. I'm not sure if that means you're able to read or not.
I would love to read.
Okay, very good. Could you read for us 2 Kings 9, verse 30 to 37?
2 Kings 9, 30 to 37. Okay, let me, I'm going to turn to it. Okay, 2 Kings 9, 30 to 37. One more page. Okay, and it reads as follows. And when Jehu had come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, and she put paint on her eyes and adorned her head and looked through a window. Then as Jehu entered at the gate, she said, "Is it peace, Zimri, murderer of your master?" And he looked up at the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And two or three eunuchs looked out at him. Then he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood spattered on the wall and on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. And when he had gone in, he ate and drank. Then he said, "Go now, see to this accursed woman, and bury her, for she was a king's daughter." So they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. Therefore they came back and told him, and he said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, 'On the plot of ground at Jezreel, dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as refuge on the surface of the field in the plot at Jezreel, so that they shall not say, here lies Jezebel.'" Over.
Okay, thank you. Very, very nice. Do you have any opening comments on this, Sister Brenda?
I think I'll pass for right now. Thank you.
Okay, very good. So, brother, opening comments on these verses we've read here. It's a picture. So, we're all offering suggestions. They're not dogmatic on it. We can start by identifying who is Jezebel. That's a little easier. Ruth.
Well, it seems like she pictures papacy, the religious element of papacy. And I had a verse, a comparative verse in Revelation 17:16.
Okay, Revelation, keep our hands here, but Revelation 17:16, okay.
"And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire." So it's not the burning with fire, but eating her flesh. And kind of reminding me of the dogs eating her up, and the only thing left was the skull and the hands and the feet, I think. And shows that, kind of reminds me of the smoke of burning going up forever and ever, that people will remember what her doctrines were and intellectually, and what she did, and how her history, her feet, they'll remember her that way, not as like a monument. Here's Jezebel. Over.
No, very good. Thank you. And while we're in the Revelation, let's take a look at Revelation and chapter 2. And Sister Cheryl, can we ask you to read Revelation 2 and let's say start in verse 18, please.
start in 18. And unto the angel of the church in Thyatira write, these things saith the Son of God, who hath his eyes like unto a flame of fire, and his feet are like fine brass. Keep reading.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't give you an end space. Sorry, right to 24.
I know thy works and charity and the service and faith and thy patience and thy works, and the last to be more than the first. Notwithstanding, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest that woman Jezebel, which calleth herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants, to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols. And I gave her space to repent of the fornication, and she repented not. Behold, I will cast her into a bed, and them that commit adultery with her into great tribulation, except they repent of their deeds. And I will kill her children with death, and all the churches shall know that I am he which searcheth the reins and hearts. And I will give unto every one of you according to your works. But unto you I say, and unto the rest in Thyatira, as many as have not this doctrine, and which have not known the depths of Satan, as they speak, I will put upon you none other burden.
All right. So opening comments here, Sister Cheryl?
Well, there's a lot here, just in relating with Jezebel being, symbolic of Babylon. It's showing the destruction of the false churches, papacy and Protestant. The time to repent, Luther's time. But she did not. Is this the third stage of the church?
This is number four.
Well, this is the fourth stage. Okay, this is the fourth stage of the church. But we just see their false doctrines. And God gave ample time through his word to repent, but she didn't. So all it involved will be destroyed with, the error. Over.
Very good. And yes, you were right in calculating. We like to think that that word space in verse 21 is time, a 360-year period of time, and it would take us from papacy's heyday during Peter Waldo's messaging to the time of the Great Reformation of Luther and his messaging. And if she hadn't corrected her ways, which she didn't, representing papacy, as you said, the Reformation would start to destroy her influence and convert many papists to become Protestants, much to the papacy's regret. But we were focusing on our verse 20, that during the peak of papal power during these dark ages, Jezebel, the woman, a harlot, a false church, papacy again, claimed to be a teacher. But whether her error of a church-state arrangement, a fornication, an illicit relationship between religion, Christian religion, and the kings of the earth was enforced, taught, enforced, and believed. And this is her great error. So it's just a way to confirm in our picture in 2 Kings, Jezebel represented the papacy. Were there any other comments here from the Revelation while we're here? Okay, we were just making that trying to make that simple point, but it's powerful. So when we do look back to our 2 Kings, who might Well, what's the eye painting or the painting of her face trying to make herself look presentable? That was mentioned last week. Who are might be the eunuchs inside the tower that throw her out? And we notice it's just a few. And then what might the dogs represent? But nonetheless, any or other symbols you'd like to comment on of the picture, we'd be happy to entertain. Brother
Dan. I should know better than I do, but what comes to mind, the eunuchs, they're with her. And so I'm thinking of the throwing down of the papacy and Protestantism in Revelation 18, to her destruction. And when the seven last plagues are poured out, the truth reveals to those who thought they were Christians, they were taught these false doctrines by papacy, especially in Protestantism, and now they know that they're not true Christians. And so they see that they've been falsely taught that they have salvation, they're going to heaven because they've conformed to the teachings of Babylon, papacy especially. And so when these tares are burned because now they know the truth and they realize they're not true Christians, they throw down papacy and Protestantism. That would be the focus of their anger and so on. So the eunuchs, we think, represent those who were formerly papist and especially over.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that. Thank you. Berkris.
Well, similarly, I think, you know, the painting of the face, typically we say it's, you know, she's adorning herself to look as good as possible. But in another sense, you could take it to a little more extreme that it's like she's hiding her real face. It's a face on top of a face, two-faced, to put it in the strongest terms. So you get that sense. And little thing on Zimri, she asked Jehu, had Zimri peace who slew his master? Well, this was this goes back to Eli, the son of Baasha, one of the kings of Israel. He reigned for 2 years, and he was overthrown by one of the captains of his guards, who was over half the chariots of his army. So he was betrayed. So she's accusing him of this betrayal. And the fact that his eunuchs at Thomas, as Brother Dan said, eunuchs were, what's the word? They were made, so that they wouldn't be a threat to the king's harem or women or wives. And so, like priests, they become celibate. They take that vow of celibacy. So there's a connection there that shows that it's part of the system of papacy. Maybe not the cardinals, but maybe so, but more so like the priests and the nunnery and those closest but higher up in the system, not particularly the attendees, the word excuse me what they'd be, but and then that's what the dogs would be, way down at the bottom, those that are now burnt tares, they're the ones that finish her off and rip her apart in the anarchy that would follow. Over.
Okay, good. Thank you. Some more additional good points. Sister Cheryl.
My comment was along with the dogs, being the burned tares, not being in a relationship with the Lord, in the same relation as the New Testament. The dogs were the Gentiles, who at the time were not in a relationship with the Lord. Only Israel was under a covenant. Over.
That's a great example. Thank you. Ruth.
I was thinking of the picture of Jezreel because it says it was in Jezreel, and that's the place where Naboth's vineyard was that they took over by lies. And so they took over this vineyard in 1 Kings 21 of this innocent man. And it just reminded me of, it was in Jezreel, and it reminded me of the winepress being trodden in Revelation 14, that the Lord is going to hold them responsible for taking over his vineyard. Over.
Yes, very good. And yes, thank you. No, excellent points. Further connection, Sister Debbie.
I was thinking that when it talks about that her blood is sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, it reminded me of the scripture in Revelations where the blood is, you know, so many furlongs in the sense of length rather than depth. So that from the wall to the horses, that was a lot of, in a sense, splatter. So that you knew she fell from a great height to make that much of a, you know, or that wide of a pattern over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Sister Roseanne.
Brother Rick, I don't know if I missed hearing this, but did anyone talk about the skull, the feet, and the palms? Because I was reading and I didn't know if someone had already talked about it. But I had notes of the skull being like the mark of the forehead. The feet were for traveling and the palms were mark of the beast. So I don't know if that has, I don't know how to put all that together, but that's what my notes are.
Okay. No, that's good. And it was mentioned earlier about the intellectual, the skull, the intellectual agreement of papacy being exposed and the marking in the hand or what papacy did. And as you say, the feet representing papal, where papacy went, where her influence had gone. So that the evidences that this was her will remain, even though as a body or a corpse, it's disgustingly eaten by the dogs and then defecated back out on the fields. So there will be no preservation of the body of papacy, but rather the testimony or witness, I think as Ruth commented, like the smoke of the burning of the city, mystic Babylon going up, there will continually be the evidence of the end result of a Antichrist system.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I think it's flowing together. Sister Debbie.
Just to show the reference in Revelations is Revelations 14:20 about the blood came forth out of the winepress onto the bridles of the horses, 1,600 furlongs. That's the reference I was talking about. Over.
Yes, and thank you. Because we see that Jezebel is killed by being trampled under the hoofs of horses. So it takes us right back to that Revelation pictures, Revelation 14, as you just mentioned, as well as Revelation 19 of the riders on the white horses, showing the doctrine of truth will lead to the destruction of papacy. We also recognize that Jezebel is in a high elevation when she is thrown down. That too reminds us of Revelation 18, that Babylon, like a great stone, is lifted up, exalted, before it's thrown down with violence into the sea to be found no more. In the sea representing the irreligious masses, that is, the bundled tares that were burned by the truth to recognize that they really weren't true Christians and they were not going to go to heaven the way they had been told by the systems. So they swallow up the papal system. And as the friends have mentioned, we have two or three eunuchs. And this voice comes from the arrival. Who's on our side? In other words, who recognizes the errors of doctrine and practice of the papacy? And apparently a small number of eunuchs, or is brought out, those of the clergy who had been dedicated celibate to papacy will participate in the destruction. Now that reminds us in a little way how we're told in the New Testament that there were some members of the Sanhedrin who actually didn't agree with the majority, like a Nicodemus and a Joseph of Arimathea. And later we read, after Pentecost, that there were even some of the priests, the Levitical priests, who ended up accepting Jesus afterwards and becoming Christians. So in a similar manner, though, we think it demonstrates that there will be some in papacy who will be so disgusted when the truth is revealed that they will turn on her from within. So even at the higher level of clergy, some will reject that system. But that's what we had here. That was the picture. Are there any other comments on this, these verses? Okay. Brother Otto.
It's interesting to note that when the Pope speaks to the crowd in St. Peter's Basilica, he speaks from a balcony and that's high. He puts on his best gear to look the best, and it wouldn't surprise me if the Lord has it that the Pope actually gets thrown out of that window just like Jezebel.
How fitting that would be.
Just to drive the point home.
Well, that's good. Would not surprise us, something like that. Poetic justice. Okay. Nice. Thank you. Brother James, Sister Molly.
Thank you, Brother Rick. I was wondering if there's any comments or interpretations of the of Jehu saying that she should be buried, when earlier in the chapter we read the prophet Elisha, when speaking to Jehu, said that she wouldn't be buried, that dogs would devour her. Is there something to that? So he heard the prophecy, but tried to go against it. Is that like a lesson for us to maybe not have sympathy for papacy, have no lasting memory of her, even because we're taught to be sympathetic high priests, but in this case, we can't be sympathetic with the destruction of papacy. Over.
Well, that's a great observation and question, and we thought about that, but I have to say I don't have a answer of substance, so maybe some others do. But that is a great, great observation. Ruth.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of when Jerusalem was being destroyed and Rome really would have liked to have saved the temple because it was like such a magnificent edifice, and that's what they really had. Because GE would be a picture of a secular force, not a religious force. And they might have some sort of respect for all these magnificent cathedrals and things like that. But the Lord said no. Like in Jerusalem, he wanted that temple destroyed. It was going to be a symbol of his past favor that was expired, and
his vengeance was going to take it down stone by stone. And so he won't allow Jezebel to be preserved. He won't allow any vestiges of honor for that system.
Well, that certainly would be fitting. Indeed, that would be true. Okay, thank you. Brother Michael.
Sorry, if I understand Brother James's question properly, is the question suggesting that even though a sympathetic high priest, we should still have a little bit of sympathy for Jezebel? Is that the question?
No, I think he was saying just the opposite. I think he was saying that this is a lesson that we nor anyone, but like Elijah, we should not have any sympathy with the Antichrist systems in their destruction.
Got it. Thank you.
But Brother James, I'll let you certainly speak for yourself on that.
Brother Rick, that was correct. Okay. He was told not to, or was told that to not bury her, but he did. He wanted to, or he asked for, and it obviously didn't happen. It wasn't God's will. So yeah, that was my question. I don't think we should have sympathy with the papal system at all. But maybe it's a picture that some, when it's being destroyed, might look back a little bit or something. Just curious. Over.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. No, that's good. Further comment? I was looking at something a little different. It's not even saying it's related. I'm not saying that at all. But it's just interesting that it's in 2 Kings and it's in the second chapter earlier, just that when Elijah was taken up and Elisha came back across the river, that the sons of the prophet wanted to go and look for the body, and Elisha had said, Don't go and do it. But they urged him, and he was kind of became embarrassed because he didn't want to see, like, he wasn't interested. He just didn't think they would find Elijah's body. And so he sent them, and they went and looked, and they came back, and they didn't find him. And he said, didn't I tell you, don't go? So it almost seems like in both these incidences anyway, not saying they're related. It just shows that there's someone saying don't do it, someone doing it. And then it actually didn't work out. And it's like, well, I told you so. That's all. Okay. Brother Chris.
Just about Jehu, you know, he was a usurper king of Israel. So he wasn't particularly a faithful, but the Lord used him for this very purpose. But then he didn't go on to be like one of the great kings that was obedient to God. Was like, he just did this thing, fulfilled this task, and then he went his own way and did his own thing. So his, who he represents or typifies is, interesting. So when he says go and bury her, like just get rid of her, as the friends are saying, they went down and the prophecy was fulfilled. There wasn't nothing left really to bury but Jesus called and a few fragments of flesh. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Good to find her. Ruth.
I was thinking of that phrase in verse 31. As Jehu entered in at the gate, she said, had Zimri peace who slew his master. I was looking that up in 1 Kings 16, that in 1 Kings 16, it was treachery. And she's saying it's treachery, which means she thought that she was the rightful queen, and he's going to be punished for destroying her. And he didn't faze him because he didn't accept that anymore. And in reality, she wasn't the rightful queen. So, over.
Well, that's very true. Yes. And, that was brought out, earlier, but we're glad you cited the verse and emphasized it. And that does make me think about that peculiar phrase in Revelation 18 when Babylon, as this woman, she says, I am a queen, I am no widow, I shall not see death. The interesting part is that when papacy goes down, she's still in an illicit relationship as if she is illicitly married to the kings, which would make her a queen. And that's true for that 1 hour of power when the kings, which had previously no power, would give their power 1 hour to the beast, a church state government, and they would make war against the Lamb, but be defeated. So when the papacy goes down, they have this brief exaltation of feeling that she's still a queen. All right. It's very nice how much we can, try to discern from such a, peculiar picture here in Kings. Sister Debbie.
I just had a question, and I'm not remembering how the story goes, but was Ahab already dead when Jehu came to get Jezebel? Because I wonder if that has anything to do. I mean, if she painted her face, she's trying to, you know, schmooze up to Jehu, you know, trying to say, well, maybe I can be a queen with this one, you know, but I'm wondering if Ahab was already dead. Over.
Okay. Comments on that question? Is Ahab already dead when Jezebel is killed? Ruth.
Well, earlier in the chapter, you have Ahaziah, king of Judah, and Joram, king of Israel. You don't have Ahab anymore in the picture. So it seems like Ahab represents an earlier time of civil power, and now we're in the later time. And then Jehu draws his bow, and he says in verse 26, surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons. That's the one whose vineyard that they stole. Saith the Lord, and I will requite thee in this plat, saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him into the plat of ground according to the word of the Lord. So I think Joram of Israel was the son.
I think you're correct. And I was just looking for the actual death of Ahab scriptures. I see, you know, you are right in that it was his son that was reigning. And I was...
First Kings 22.
You'd like to read that for us, please?
Go back to First Kings 22, verse 37. So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And go down to verse 40. So Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah, his son, reigned in his stead. Now he died in battle. The arrow found one little weak spot in his armor, took him out.
Excuse me, brother Chris, would you repeat the scriptures?
1 Kings chapter 22, verses 37 through 40, talks about the actual death of Ahab, but the whole chapter is about his demise.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. Brother Godwin?
I had similar the same verses in 1 Kings 22:40, and we could also see in 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 11, that Jehu slew the remnant of the house of Ahab. And in 13, mentioning again, Jehu met with the brethren of Ahaziah. So just connecting all those together.
Oh, that's good. We like that because that's how we try to remember how we can find our events in the Old Testament. And one of the keys is looking at the beginning of a book and the ending of a book. So Brother Chris took us to the end of the book of end of the book of 1 Kings. But take a look at the first verse of 2 Kings, first chapter, first verse. Then Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. It goes on. So again, that method of trying to locate things in the Old Testament, look at the beginning of a book and the end of a book, and it helps you zero in on what events might be covered in between. And it does become, it's just a good remembering tool. But thank you. Ruth.
Extremely confusing because when you get to 2 Kings 9, you've got Ahaziah as the king of Judah and Joram as the king of Israel. And in 2 Kings 8, the Ahaziah is showing you the Ahaziah in 2 Kings is the king of Judah and Joram is the king of, or the son of Ahab. So you got like flipping some names around.
That's true. And then I could point out some other problems, but that's not today's lesson.
Okay, sorry.
Sister Debbie.
So then we can maybe see a similarity with Jezebel probably painting her face to try to seduce Jehu, thinking that she could, you know, well, I'm still beautiful. I can still, you know, the I'm not a widow idea and finding out that, no, you know, it's like Babylon to the very end is trying to put on this face, trying to seduce the population into believing her. Over.
That's true. And I'll make a couple more connections. Ahab probably represents the pre-1914 monarchy kings who had a relationship with her and they have done away with in 1914. So in Revelation 17, we learn there are 10 kings which had no power as kings yet. That shows kings of the future, not monarchy kings, but kings of finance and policy and government and militaries, that the kings of the future will once again have a brief hour of power united with the religious leaders. The eighth head is of the seven. So it is a repeat of the church state head that had existed previously. So yeah, she still tries to paint her face in the end. We talked a little bit in Isaiah 23 last week. Let's look at Isaiah 23. We went through the 70 years that the harlot was forgotten. There the city is Tyre. And then at the end of the 70 years, she goes about returning to her hire as a prostitute, committing fornication with the kings of the earth. She's getting herself back into a relationship with the various governments of earth, the powerful beings. But in verse 18, that was the interesting part. Her gain as a prostitute and her hire as a prostitute shall be holiness to the Lord. Well, not really. The hire of a prostitute's never holy to the Lord, actually. But she presents it as if it looks like holiness to the Lord. In what way? It shall not be treasured or laid up. For her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. So the papacy today, instead of continuing to spend the money on themselves, like the popes during the Dark Ages, rather they are presenting that they represent the poor people of the world, the Lord's poor people, and then they use the money that they receive from governments, like we brought out for Catholic charities and various things, to then give it to the poor to, as it were, paint her face that she is still a desirable system to work through and be in a relationship with, rather than a bunch of anathemas and curses. They're trying to make themselves look more appealing to the people. So it makes us think of that. Sister Debbie.
Just a quick question, because I misunderstood or what you said. Are you intimating that monarchies will come back as these kings, or are you just stating governments in general? Over.
I didn't state that monarchies would come back. They had their day. But the modern kings, Brother Russell says it clearly in the fourth volume, Forward and Elsewhere, the modern kings, governments, financial kings, civil kings, military rulers, that was what he thought. Even though we have to say in the second volume we read in our studies here, that Brother Russell does bring out, he would not be surprised if in the future there would be a strong government, like a monarchy, even in this country. But we're not saying that monarchies are coming back, per se. But the strong governments will act in the way that, for 1 hour, very brief, they'll act in a way that monarchs of old had. Controlling. Okay. I hope that helps. Was there anything more on this picture with Jezebel? Okay. We thought the good discussion, good connections to the possible relationship with, the pouring out of the seven last plagues and then the events that take place. So in concluding, that chapter 16, if you had our notes, we're on page, what I call page 8. The last page, regardless. And we had the seven last plagues. We had 4 points. And, does someone have those? You get a break from listening to me. They could read them. Brother Mark, you like to read those for us, please?
All right. Seven last plagues. What, number one is, what are they? They are condensed truths. Number two, when are they poured out? And the answer is in the future, after the 144,000 are sealed, some remaining in the flesh. Number three, upon who or what are they poured? And the response is the nominal church systems and the bundle tares. And number four, who will pour them out? All of the 144,001, the feet members of the body of Christ on this side of the veil, while the remainder of the Christ in the spirit realm are working with them from beyond the veil.
Over. Okay. All right. Thank you. So these are the suggested conclusions. Not all the brotherhood believe that. That's okay. It's prophetic. We'll see. But nonetheless, this was the conclusion of the study as we saw it. Does this elicit any comments or questions? We'll leave Revelation 16 behind. Was there any closing comments on that chapter of the Bible? Sister Cheryl.
Well, I'll just bring out the final thing you have written in the notes, which is very encouraging for us, as Jesus told us, but when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given you in the same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speak, but the Spirit of your Father, which speaketh through you. Matthew 10:19-20. Over.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that very much. Brother James.
I apologize if this was already mentioned, but I think I have it right in my mind, but I'm not sure. So I wanted to run it by you. Just tell me if I'm right or wrong in this. But in your number two here, the another, there is in the future after the 144,000 are sealed, some remaining in the flesh. Would, so here's my question. Would Ezekiel 9 verse 11, and speaking of the man in linen with the inkhorn, says, I have done as you commanded. Is that a sign of the church being complete?
Yes, I think so.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good question. Brother Dan.
And a similar comment as, I guess, the last two concerning the Lord's care for us, preparation, sealing the true church in their forehead, providing the harvest message. And so we don't have to be anxious about what we will say as we're thinking about the future and the privilege of speaking forth these truths that will bring down Christendom, these seven last plaguing truths. We're not to worry about the circumstances or we're not to be memorizing speeches and so on, but to continue to study the Bible, the harvest message, continue to be developed by the truth and to do the work while it's still day. And the Lord will provide the circumstances and the words, because we've been studying to the best of our ability these prophetic things as well as the entire plan of God. And so the Lord is in charge, and he will care for us and will help us at that time. Over.
Okay, thank you, Brother Dan. Nice summation. Ruth.
Well, one of the things that encourages me about this study that we spent time on is that these plaguing truths are not technicalities. They're basic truths that we all know. And they're like, really, you don't have to be particularly brilliant or educated or smart or anything like that to recognize them. So it's like for the common people like us to recognize and stand up for. So, over.
Very true. And I always find it a joyful thing when we speak on the topic of the seven last plagues, that these are truths that any sister or brother put on trial or put in a position to be able to express their views would be able to do so. As long as they have the Spirit of the Lord and they've put these things in their heart and mind by study. That's the key. It's not suddenly something's going to come to mind that we didn't know. But since God doesn't work like that, it's not something magical. It's that the Lord creates the environment and the Spirit of enlightenment moves us to speak that which we've learned and studied. But any one of us has that privilege and opportunity. So, okay, very good. Any last comments here on the 16th chapter? All right. So, after a long time, we have finally reached our conclusion. And next week, Lord willing, we'll start the 17th chapter. I can't see a point of starting that now. I would suggest that for those who've been in the Revelation study, and if you don't have it, if you look and you don't have it, let me know. We talked about the heads and the horns. We had a side study, and we had some handouts and some outlines, if you will, that we sent out, and we studied that together. Well, we looked into Daniel, and we looked at Revelation, particularly the 17th chapter, but we considered wherever we had heads and horns throughout Revelation so that we could reassure ourselves. So if you have your notes from that, that's useful, because in the 17th chapter we have heads and horns. So we did go, believe it or not, verse by verse through chapter 17 and in an expedited way. So we'll go through it now as a class, and maybe we'll go through it quickly because we've been through it. We hope to write down notes and put that together like we have on the last few chapters. And but nonetheless, that's where we'll start next week, Lord willing.